From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with journalist James Conaway. His book, The Kingdom in the Country, compares our romantic image of the Wild West with the modern reality. To prepare it, he spent 6 months talking with cowboys, bureaucrats, and gunfighters who make their lives there. Also today, the humor of Margaret Smith, a stand-up comic who says she isn't on stage to get love, she's there to get even. Rock critic Ken Tucker sorts through the paradoxical career of Frank Zappa, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Married to the Mob. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. A few years ago, my guest James Conaway interviewed the controversial Secretary of the Interior, James Watt, for a Washington Post story. When Conaway walked into Watt's office, he experienced an epiphany. The Pentagon may have the power to destroy, but the Interior Department has real estate, millions of prime acres in the West. That public land captured Conaway's imagination, not only because it has been preserved from private ownership, but also because it's the province of American legend, of cowboys, gold miners, gunslingers, and other loners looking for fortune or freedom. Conaway left his Washington Post job and took off for the public lands of the West to see how those legends compare to today's reality. He's written a book titled The Kingdom in the Country, about the inhabitants and the bureaucrats of the land nobody owns. James Conaway has traveled extensively. In 1981, he backpacked within a few hundred miles of the North Pole for a National Geographic story. He grew up in Tennessee, and he's also written for the New York Times Magazine, Harper's, and The Atlantic, and he's written 4 other books. James Conaway, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Have you had romantic visions of the Wild West? Did you grow up with romantic visions?
Well, I grew up on the edge of the West, or at least one notion of the West, in Memphis, Tennessee. When I was a teenager, Memphis boasted of having more churches than gas stations, which was not a settling thought for a teenager. I used to dream of escaping to the West, although I didn't really know it, and I never got out there until years later. I lived for a while in California, and I worked in various Western states, but didn't feel that I knew the West the way I wanted to.
Was your image of the West shaped by movies or by something else?
Of course, it was shaped by movies. It was also shaped by my own family that had spent time out there. My father was a wrangler 1 year just for the heck of it, and his old spurs hung on our wall in Memphis, and just as they hang on my wall today in Washington. And I used to look at them and think that here was a symbol of a man who didn't care much about horses but was interested in escape. And I think that was what really drew me out west.
I'd like to get a sense of the public land that exists now in America. Which states does it cover? And we'll get to the basic rules about it afterwards. Why don't we start with how extensive it is and in which states?
Well, the way it came home to me, which I think would give you a better picture of it, is I went home after I'd done an interview with Watt, and I spread a map of public lands on the floor of my living room. And I realized that in the West, we're talking about the 11 intermountain states from the Rocky Mountains extending westward. I realized that a person could travel from Mexico to Canada and seldom have to leave these lands and never get out of sight of them. That, in fact, was the kingdom of the title of my book, The Kingdom in the Country. And it occurred to me that places in Washington State had a great deal in common with places in New Mexico, although they might not know it, that here was an entity that was governed by its own rules, its own regulations, and had its own history. I suspected that it was a repository for what still endured of the notion of the American West, and I set out to find out if that was in fact the case.
What are some of the basic rules about who can use the public land and how it can be used?
Well, the uses of public lands are varied, and the influence of them is vast. The most obvious users are cattlemen and sheepmen who lease parts of the West to run their animals on. Many of the huge ranches that we hear of in the West are, in fact, a small part of private land where the rancher has his house, and vast acreless tracts where he leases to run the animals. Besides that, there's there's timbering, there's mining, and then there's a great deal of illegal activity among it, the stealing of Indian artifacts, which I got into. There's the growing of marijuana on public lands all over the West. And there are those marginal enterprises like all-terrain vehicles that careen around the desert areas that are strictly legal, but the activity is lawless.
Part of the myth of the West is that it was always a refuge for loners, for drifters, for outlaws. Is that still the case?
Absolutely. It's a refuge for what I suppose you could call individualists. There's a lot of talk in the East about individualism, but there are many Easterners who wouldn't know an individual if he was served to them on a cracker. And I was struck most by the variety and the intensity of private life as it is lived, either on public lands or as it is influenced by public lands. There were many stories, but there's a man in Wyoming who still makes his living. I call him a gunfighter. He calls himself a range detective. He's a man who has made his reputation with his gun. He could have stepped out of the 1870s. When I found him in a remote part of Wyoming where sheep rustling is still a viable career choice, he was hired by a rancher to more or less defend 30,000 acres. He has had a unique form of job security. As he told me, one ranch hires me and I run the rustlers off and they go next door and then they hire me. It's a quite incredible story, but he demonstrated how fast he was with his gun, first unloading it, then showing how he draws and shoots from the hip, performing a circular motion, a quite fluid experience, quite fast. Then he reloaded his gun and turned as if to go back into the house that he lives, and suddenly the gun was in his hand. It was literally faster than I could see. I saw something in his eyes, these cornflower blue eyes that I had not ever seen in a person's eyes before.
What?
It was a certain implacable, impersonal force that made the hair stand up quite literally on the back of my neck. Then the gun went off with a tremendous crash and a rock about the size of a 50-cent piece, 15 or 20 feet away, jumped up in the air. He had just nicked the upper corner of it, and he sort of shrugged his shoulders and said, "Shooting high today," and put the gun back in his holster and went in the house.
This is a fellow named Ed Cantrell, who you write about in The Kingdom and the Country. How did you meet up with him? Hadn't you heard a lot of stories about him before you actually found him?
Yes, I read a story about him being tried for murder in Rock Springs, Wyoming, about a decade before. And there was a newspaper story in a newspaper out west at some point where he had been interviewed, and the person who wrote the interview said something about his being a range detective in the area around Casper, Wyoming, but I could not find him. No one knew where he was. I called his lawyer. I called a person that he had worked for in another part of Wyoming who said, "Ed's a good man, but he likes to work alone." Eventually, somebody came up with an old telephone number of a ranch. I called the number many times. No one ever answered. I found myself in Wyoming doing another aspect of the book, and I said, "What the heck? I think I'll just go there and see if I can find him." And in fact, I did. I lucked out, and he was there, and we spent some time together, during which he showed me how to draw and showed me some of the other techniques that he uses in his business.
So is this a guy who just travels around the public lands looking for business?
Well, he travels around the West, as I said, from one ranch to another, and his job is to discourage people from rustling. Whether or not he actually shoots people doesn't seem to matter. It's really his reputation, and the point being that the West in that sense hasn't changed. Gunfighters always live by their reputation. They got more done and encountered more danger because of what they were reputed to be able to do rather than what they actually did. The power of guns is really what we're talking about, the prevalence of guns in the West. Guns were everywhere. Their import was much greater than the collective muzzle velocity, I think. There are fewer people get shot in the West probably nowadays. The the number of people who get shot in relation to the number of guns that exist is really quite minuscule. But here was a person who actually made his living, if not using his gun, with the reputation of what his gun could do. And in that sense, nothing has changed in more than a century of the West.
My guest is journalist James Conaway, and we're talking about the subject of his book, The Kingdom in the Country, which is about the miners, the wranglers, the cowboys, the bureaucrats, and the gunfighters who live in the public lands in the West. In your book, you suggest that the classic cowboys were closer to 19th century hippies than they ever were to the kind of John Wayne cowboy image that we have. Can I ask you to describe what you mean by that?
Well, cowboys have traditionally done dangerous, dirty, very difficult work. I didn't realize how difficult it was till I took part in a couple of roundups in the West. Probably the best cowboys today and the ones who are engaged in the most dangerous pastime are those who round up wild horses. This is a relatively small band of cowboys. They travel where the wild horses are, which is in the middle of vast tracts of public lands, usually in Nevada. That's the most common state. There are probably 40 or 50,000 wild horses out on the range. They're not easy to catch. You have to be a good rider, but you also have to be able to work in concert with a helicopter, which is used to corral them. The cowboys that I was talking about in the 19th century were people who were willing to take a bedroll and a change of clothes and get on a horse and ride from Texas to Montana. They didn't expect a lot out of life except freedom and the ability to do what they wanted to do. I think these men are like that today. The curious thing is that they are heavily dependent upon, in this case, American Express. The man that I was with owed American Express $50,000. He was living on credit, waiting to get paid for the federal government for all the horses he had rounded up. He and his partner had also wrecked two helicopters within the last 6 months. As he said, that makes the insurance companies real nervous. I asked the pilot how does one go about surviving a helicopter crash? Your chances are not very good, as you probably know. And he said, well, you just sit there and you wait till things stop flying around and then you jump out. So I pass that along in case you ever need it.
Gee, I hope not. The 40,000 to 50,000 wild horses that you mentioned, I always figured that they were part of the legacy of the Wild West, but the way you explain it in your book, they're actually more of a legacy of the Depression.
Well, they are a legacy in a way of the Wild West. I mean, the horses came here, they came to the West, but they are envisioned by what I call the wild horse lobby, which is an urban phenomenon. It's not a Western rural phenomenon. They are envisioned as descendants of the mounts of the conquistadors, which is not the case. They are the descendants of nags that were turned out during the Depression because people couldn't afford to feed them. They are not, by and large, they are not beautiful animals. They are usually scarred. They fight a lot among themselves. They're not too healthy. They eat a lot more than a cow does. They're destructive to the range. Some of them should indeed exist, I agree, but not 40,000. Also, I don't think that we as American citizens should pay $20 million a year just to preserve them, to put them in feedlots and feed them hay until they drop dead of old age, which is in fact the case. I think they should be usefully employed in some way, even if that means putting them into dog food. This is something that people don't want to hear, and I've been criticized quite a bit about this as being insensitive to the plight of animals. All I'm saying is that the wild horse is a poor symbol of the wild and untrammeled West, and that the people who are supporting them, I think their sentiments are quite good, just misplaced. I wish they would shift their emphasis to the grizzly bear, which is a creature that really needs them and is really the great symbol of what we're talking about here, a place where man's dominion is not complete and where there's still a chance to encounter something in the wilds that is bigger than we are.
So the way you're describing it, a lot of the people who live out in the West resent the groups that have been established to try to preserve the wild horses.
Well, some of them do. The ranchers, of course, don't like to run cows in competition with the horses. In my opinion, the range is overused, whether it's by horses, wild horses, cows, burros, or sheep. The real point I'm making is that people don't realize the competition that exists for a very limited amount of resources in the West, particularly in the arid parts.
So for food, for instance, the horses are grazing on land that the cattlemen and the sheep herders want for their herds.
Yes, that's right. But all of this land, in fact, belongs to us, to you and me. It's a public resource, and it should be, in my opinion, there should be less grazing of all sorts on it. The other point I was going to make was that people in the West have no affection for wild horses by and large. They also, by and large, a lot of them don't have much affection for the grizzly bear. But it's two very different questions, and one of them, in my opinion, is a lot more important symbolically than the other. I'm speaking of the grizz.
Now, while we're on the subject of horses and cowboys, a lot of the cowboys now are using dirt bikes to herd cattle instead of horses.
Well, that's true. Dirt bike ranching is a real phenomenon in the West. I spent some time with a rancher in New Mexico, a fellow I liked quite a bit, although politically we didn't agree on much, but personally we got along quite well. He has not saddled a horse in 5 years. And I asked him one day why he preferred a dirt bike, and he jerked his thumb at his Honda that was parked in the shade of his house and said, "When that thing's sitting there, it ain't eating," which I thought was one of the most eloquent descriptions that I'd ever heard.
So, I guess there's as much of a fantasy life around motorcycles as there is around horses, too, don't you think?
Absolutely. There's not much difference there. You spend, I guess the big difference is if you have a dirt bike, as a rancher, you spend a lot less time
grooming it.
that's right, and knowing it. And in fact, I think the person is diminished in the process, because a machine is not the same thing. An animal, you know, an animal has a personality. Horses are wonderful animals, and I think they lent a great deal to life in the West as we knew it. There are people who, however, who do spend more time on their machines than people ever spent on horses, and I'm talking about those who ride all-terrain vehicles, which are these three-wheeled jobs that will go almost anywhere in the West. These are urbanites who bring these machines out of places like San Diego and Los Angeles and other cities to romp in the wilderness, and they do more damage per square mile probably than anything other than strip mining. They have a culture of their own. They arrive in by the thousands in certain areas of the desert in Southern California. And at night, you cannot believe the matrix of flashing blue, green, red, and yellow lights that cover these sand dunes while thousands of people are competing, driving in all directions. There's no speed limit. There's no direction you can or cannot go in. People are constantly having accidents. There are horrible deaths as a result of this. It also seems to give rise to some sort of strange cultural manifestation whereby people torch public toilets and shoot occasionally Uzis through one another's trailers. It's an inexplicable phenomenon, and one that's terrifying but fascinating.
Well, I want to talk more about your travels through the West, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is James Conaway, a journalist who's the author of The Kingdom in the Country, which is about the West as it is today in the public lands in the West. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Journalist James Conaway is my guest, and he's speaking to us from NPR member station KUOW in Seattle, Washington. We were just talking about all the recreational dirt bikers that come in and tear up the land and all the subsequent battles that ensue around that. You describe in your book constant friction between the ranchers and the recreationalists in the public lands. Do the battles go beyond the dirt bikers who come in?
Oh, yes, I think they do. The dirt bikers often are competing just with the animals and the vegetation in the particular areas they use. Some of these areas are too remote, actually, to run cattle. But the conflicts over public lands are not limited to ranchers and recreationists. They go all the way up to people who strip mine coal in Montana, people who do seismic shooting to discover oil and gas deposits in various national forests. It's really in the end the question of who owns these lands and how they should be used. And it goes back in history as far as the white man has gone in the history of the West. Some people view the West as a national treasure that should in some ways be preserved. I'm not saying that you should have no development, should have no grazing. That would be foolish. But I think that the West, considering what has happened to the rest of the United States, that it has not had some public land laws to preserve it from development, shows that what we have in the West should be preserved as a national treasure. There are other people historically who have viewed the West as a place to plunder, whether they are miners or ranchers or whatever. And that those two basic positions are the ones that have been at war ever since we've had a West as we know it. They are at war today. You can say there's nothing new about it, but in fact the process has been greatly accelerated by numbers of people who live in the country, by the power of machines, and by the demands for resources and the money it produces. So although it's an old argument and an old battle, it has a certain heightened poignancy now, in my opinion.
Now, I want to ask you briefly about another unusual use that some of the public lands are being put to, and that is the growing of marijuana as a cash crop for the people who plant it. And there are incredible efforts to destroy these marijuana crops. Now, you describe the marijuana crops as being environmentally bad. Would you explain that?
Well, let me back up just a little bit. The marijuana question is much more complicated than people think. Marijuana is grown in great quantities on public lands, often by people who buy land that's adjacent to public lands and move over and grow on the public land so that theoretically they can't be caught. There are parts of the United States, one of which I visited and wrote about in The Kingdom in the Country, which is in Humboldt County in California, where the entire culture is permeated by marijuana. It affects everything from real estate values to what kids buy at the candy store because the kids make money preparing the marijuana for sale. The elected officials, because they are elected, will not arrest anyone for growing marijuana. Consequently, you have the feds who have to come in or feel they have to come in helicopters to try to destroy the source of all revenues in this particular community. It's a fascinating idea. It's the same as visiting a community that would be dependent upon coal or oil or newspapers or whatever. The problem with it is, and I must add that I was in some ways had some respect for the entrepreneurs who would go out and grow this marijuana and then sell it like any other product, but I was dismayed by what they often do to the environment. Marijuana growing today is not It's not as simple as you might imagine. You don't go out and just push a seed into the ground and go and harvest it. They have huge plastic tanks that hold water and fertilizer. They have miles of plastic pipe that bleeds the water and the fertilizer into the plants. They have tons of pesticides that they use to kill wood rats and deer that feed on the marijuana. These animals are killed, and then they're picked up by the raptors and the other things in the food chain, and these pesticides and poisons work themselves all the way down into the trout, into the salmon. So in fact, it's a pervasive thing. Also, a lot of the growers tend to dump their trash because they live in remote areas into the watershed. That also is not good. The thing that dismayed me most, I think, was the fact that children are often used to prepare marijuana, and and in some cases quite in a quite in, I can't say innocent, but in a sincere manner. There was one marijuana grower I spent time with, saw himself as a small farmer. He did not make a moral distinction between growing marijuana and growing grapes. His kids had their own bank accounts. His kids helped prepare, or what they call manicure marijuana, during the season, and he felt that it was a legitimate way to live. That was his view. The other manifestations of marijuana growing that I saw was that people would, in this town, would rent motel rooms, take their entire crop of marijuana into the motel rooms in plastic bags, spread it around on the floor, turn up the heater, and leave for 2 days until it dried out, and then come back and prepare it and sell it. That tells you how pervasive it is in the culture if that sort of thing can happen and the sheriff's office is 200 yards away and they don't do anything about it. That, to me, was a fascinating development.
We only have a couple of minutes left. I'm a little interested in how this trip affected you. After 6 months of being out west and traveling around, living a very itinerant life, you went back home to Washington, D.C. to continue your life in the city. Was it difficult to pick up where you left off in the city?
Yes, it was difficult. Fortunately, I had the book to write, which I did with a great amount of concentration. But the West showed me something that I suspected existed in myself, that was a need to get out of the city and to realize that the West still harbors chances for Americans as it always had. I have to say that writing the book changed my life. The American West changed my life.
How did it change your life?
Well, it made me aware of that there were possibilities beyond what I was doing, that I should look to myself for my own resources, and that I should do the things I want to do rather than what other people tell me to do professionally, which is what, in fact, I've been doing since then.
It's funny, because what you just said is a kind of restatement of what the whole ethic of the West is, a place to do what you want to do and to not have to be told what to do.
Well, I think that's always been important to Americans. I think it still is. You know, the Census Bureau said there was no frontier in 1890. They were unable to find a difference between civilized and uncivilized areas. But I can tell you that there is a frontier still out there.
Did you ever feel like you were in a movie when you were out working with the cowboys?
Well, I didn't, because the country itself is so overpowering that any sort of, I think any medium is going to have a hard time capturing it. I depended upon the written word, which I think is the old-timey one, but in some ways the most appropriate.
James Conaway, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
James Conaway's book, The Kingdom in the Country, is published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner, designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet Margaret Smith, a comic with a deadpan delivery and a deadly wit. Maybe you've seen her on David Letterman or in the new movie, The Blob. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Frank Zappa's latest project, a 13-hour CD collection of his earlier recordings and some live performances. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Married to the Mob, the new movie by director Jonathan Demme. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. Vice President George Bush, who receives his party's presidential nomination tonight, has spent much of the day dealing with problems concerning his choice of a running mate, Senator Dan Quayle's service in the National Guard during the Vietnam War, and the way Quayle has handled questions about it have raised doubts about the vice president's choice. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
On the surface, all was normal today in the Bush campaign. The vice president addressed delegates from Texas this morning, dropped by a tribute to his wife, Barbara, and spoke to wealthy Republican donors this afternoon. The vice president's line, that he's ready to take charge of the Republican Party and the country. But instead of savoring the spotlight, the campaign was dogged by questions over Quayle's actions 19 years ago, when he joined the National Guard while attending law school and avoided serving in Vietnam. It was reported today by a paper Quayle's family owns that the former managing editor of the paper intervened to make sure Quayle got into the Guard, but the vice president stood behind his choice.
I don't think I could have selected anybody that'll do more to help the election than Dan Quayle of Indiana. He is going to be outstanding on this ticket.
Meanwhile, campaign officials insist that not a single thought has been given to dropping Quayle from the ticket. I'm Brian Naylor in New Orleans.
The Democratic standard-bearer Michael Dukakis visited the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama this afternoon before heading to Birmingham for a stop at a black church where he called on black voters to join him in resolving that every form of bigotry and racism be banished from this land. Dukakis began his day with a news conference in Miami. After congratulating George Bush on winning the Republican nomination, he launched into an attack on Bush's record on two key campaign issues. Alan Tomlinson reports.
Dukakis hit out first at Bush's record on fighting drugs. He said the United States was losing the drug war and Bush had to share the blame. President Reagan, he recalled, had put the vice president in charge of a narcotics task force.
It was a failure. He doesn't show up at meetings of the committee. So what's the point of repeating failure?
Dukakis said what is needed is a cabinet-level drug czar to fight narcotics full-time. On taxation, he hit back at Republican claims that the Democrats will raise taxes while Bush will not.
But the vice president broke his no-tax pledge 3 days after he made it. So who's kidding whom?
Dukakis said now that both parties have made their nominations, he's looking forward to debating these issues. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Tomlinson in Miami.
The White House announced today that it will tell the General Accounting Office it cannot provide information involving possible illegal activities by Panamanian General Manuel Noriega. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater added that the administration will respond, quote, in an appropriate manner if the GAO reformulates its request in a manner consistent with its statutory authority and the legal principles involved. The GAO is making a study of ways that information about drug trafficking by foreign officials influences decisions by the United States on foreign policy. Noriega has been indicted on drug trafficking charges by two federal grand juries in Florida. NASA's plans to resume space shuttle flights this fall got a big boost today as redesigned O-rings apparently passed their toughest test to date. Engineers deliberately riddled the new O-ring joints with 14 major defects, then tested the seal by firing a full-size solid rocket booster, which was anchored on its side at the Morton Thiokol plant in Utah. Despite the deliberate defects, the joints held their own, and jubilant engineers declared the booster ready to fly. Westinghouse has tentatively agreed to a $35 million settlement of two age discrimination suits. The general counsel of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission announced the settlement today. He said it's believed to be the largest in agency history. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained just over a point to close at 2027.03. You're listening to National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Frank Zappa is currently producing a series of compact discs featuring previously unreleased recordings of his live performances, including his work with the Mothers of Invention. Rock critic Ken Tucker has some thoughts on the merits of this project.
I may be vile and pernicious, but you can't look away. I make you think I'm delicious with the stuff that I say. I am the best you can get. Have you guessed me yet? Well, I'm the slime oozing out from your TV set.
Frank Zappa is one of those unclassifiable rock musicians who can fairly be called an eccentric, a sourpuss, a genius, and a creep. He's recorded over 50 albums since he began his career in the late 60s with the Mothers of Invention. In recent years, he's become the most outspoken rock star to oppose the censorship of the Parents Music Resource Center. A project is currently underway to get many of Zappa's concert performances released on compact disc. The CD company Ryko Disc recently began a series called You Can't Do That on Stage Anymore. The first volume includes songs from Frank Zappa shows recorded between 1969 and 1982. Over the next couple of years, Ryko Disc is planning to gradually release 6 double CD sets that will total more than 13 hours of music. The question is this effort worth it?
Well, I turned around and I said, ho, ho. Well, I turned around and I said one more time, ho, ho. Well, I turned around and I said, just for Vinny, ho, ho. And the northern lights commenced to glow. Huskies go, don't you eat that yellow snow. Watch out where the Huskies go, don't you eat that yellow snow. Right about that time, people, a fur trapper who was strictly from commercial had the unmitigated audacity to jump up from behind my igloo.
That's Don't Eat the Yellow Snow, the mere start of a 20-minute performance, the tip of a discolored iceberg, as it were. This is a good example of what might be called the Zappa paradox, an exceptionally talented, often quite original musician who is constantly subverting his own good music to make dumb, dirty jokes. Zappa's answer to this is that if all he made was good music, he wouldn't have the large, business-supporting cult following he has. It's probably true that Zappa's mostly male audience discovers him in high school, when his mixture of rock, blues, 20th century classical, jazz, and opera combines with his excessive vulgarity to make him seem a daring, liberating musician. After a while, though, the genius versus the jerk question occurs to the listener. If you come to think he's a jerk, you move on to Ornette Coleman and U2. If you decide he's a genius, you start giving your money to Ryko Disc. For in addition to these performances, the company has put most of Zappa's studio recordings onto crisp-sounding CDs. These include undeniably first-rate albums like Freak Out and Hot Rats. That's You Didn't Try to Call Me, recorded in 1980 in Munich, featuring Ike Willis on vocals. Over the years, Zappa has gone through a slew of musicians, some of whom are or were famous. These include Mark Volman and Howard Kalin of the Turtles, the late Lowell George of Little Feat, jazz musician George Duke, and guitarist Steve Vai, now in David Lee Roth's band. No one with any originality stays long with Zappa, because you have to submit to his will, and that can lead you to anything from witty pastiche to bad toilet jokes. More dispiriting, I would think, is constant exposure to the Zappa worldview, which holds that the audience is a bunch of idiots and that pop culture is relentlessly greedy and venal. It's a measure of Zappa's talent that he's managed to last as long as he has with that attitude. That attitude, in fact, got him a hit in 1982 with Valley Girl, a novelty tune sung by his daughter, Moon Unit Zappa. But this is finally what makes Frank Zappa a marginal rock figure. He's working in a genre for which he ultimately has contempt, and given that context, even genius can sound intriguing and yet wear thin pretty fast.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. Margaret Smith is not your manic, hey, let's have a good time kind of comic. She has a slow, deadpan delivery that has a slightly hostile edge. People, she says, make her feel pro-nuclear. Smith got her start at Chicago's famed Second City Theater. She's opened for Jay Leno and played all the big comedy clubs. And she's now appearing in the movie The Blob. But Margaret Smith is still probably best known for her appearances on The David Letterman Show.
My father was no prize. He was a gambler and an alcoholic. But he was also very vain. So one day he gave up his vices to save up enough money for a hair transplant. 2 days after the transplant was complete, he got drunk and on a $20 bet shaved his head. So I owe him $20.
You know, there's a lot of spaces in between lines when you're performing. I was wondering if that ever makes your audiences uncomfortable. And I ask in part because so many comics are really manic and fill up all the spaces with their own laughs, if nothing else.
I hope so.
You hope it makes them uncomfortable?
Yeah.
How come?
Because I am, and I want them in the same boat.
You know, sometimes, even though you have this really deadpan style, it looks like you're going to laugh anyways.
I do laugh.
Uh-huh.
I laugh on stage, but usually they're not funny. You know, I mean, I'm not going to laugh at my own stuff unless, you know, I'm improvising, which I do more and more. So, you know, I don't strictly deadpan anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not, by nature, a real bubbly person.
Some of us who aren't naturally bubbly have had it pointed out to us by many people who say, oh, you look unhappy. What's wrong? How come you're not smiling?
Yeah. Well, mainly because you're here. That's what you tell me.
I'll remember
when
that.
When you leave, I'll smile like a lark.
Were you ever inclined, when you started performing, to change your name from Margaret Smith, Smith being your prototypical common name, your everyman name?
Well,
I went to visit my mother once in Florida, and I woke up early one morning and thought I'd take a romantic walk along the pier. My mother lives right on the ocean. So I get out, and it's windy, and I'm bundled up, and it's, you know, like a movie. Well, my mother's friend jumps out of a car, comes running up to me, telling me, "I couldn't sleep all night. You got to change your name. I don't know, you might like this, you might not. Tell me what you think. You ready?" I said, "Yes." "Peggy Glass." "Peggy Glass sure has a lot of sass and class."
Oh, gosh.
I said, "I'll think about it." "Okay, you let me know. I'm telling you, you got to get rid of that Smith thing."
"My last name is Smith. It's very boring. So I try to think up things to do to make it more interesting. Like when I check into a hotel room, I purposely don't write my last name down to get the hotel clerk to demand it. And then I go, Smith. Yeah, that's it, Smith."
I'm interested in how you work up your material. I love what you have to say about hating to wear red lipstick on stage.
Oh, yeah.
"I hate my manager. He's always telling me, wear red lipstick, look nice up there. I said, what if I'm not funny and it's coming out of these big old red lips? It's like being a crummy outfielder with a paisley mitt."
Now, how did you come up with that image of it being like an outfielder, like a crummy outfielder with a paisley glove?
Well, because I also am an athlete.
Oh.
And I played a lot of softball. I've been in leagues since I was in grade school. And so that's a big part of my life. So I thought, you know, I had this a manager years ago telling me, you know, "You gotta look nice up there, you know, put on some red lipstick. You really gotta, you know." And so I resented, you know, being told how to look. So when I sat down to write it, I thought it would be like being a crummy outfielder with a paisley mitt. You know, why draw attention? I don't know. I guess my images, they come from my real life.
You have a lot of material about how much you dislike your family. I'm thinking it must be pretty hard to convince them that this is just part of your material. I mean, what do you tell them after they've heard your performances?
They don't ask anything. They know that I had a hard time as an adolescent growing up. And so they figure, let her just get it off her chest. Let her get even, you know.
You're acting now. You have a role in both The Blob and Vibes. Is that going to be... Are you pursuing this now, an acting career?
Yes.
How come? Do you want to supplement your work as a stand-up?
Well, I want to make a transition mm-hmm. from stand-up to performing in and writing movies.
How come?
Because stand-up comedy no longer excites me. I don't even know if I should be saying this. I get excited about my shows. I don't want you to think I don't. But the quality, how special stand-up used to be, is gone.
Why?
Well, because I don't even know if I know how to begin this, but I feel very strongly about that comedy is not what it used to be. There are I find so many comedians out there who lack integrity to the point where I can't stand the way a lot of comedians make women look,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of the stuff is racist. You know, it's just, and it seems to be that when we allowed ourselves to be angry young comedians, it's gone out of hand.
So part of the reason why you want to get out of comedy is because you don't want to be associated with certain other comics.
I guess I, you know, it breaks my heart because I've always thought of comedy as an art form.
Mm-hmm.
And not, you know, some kind of arena for, you know, men to get out their hostilities on women. When I hear stuff like that come out of people, which I guess I expect, but then when people cheer it, I say, oh boy, I do not belong here. Get me out of here. Get me in movies and get me in maybe a theater someday. Maybe a theater audience.
Well, I wish you the best in the movies.
Yeah, I'm doing real good. Uh-huh. I like, you know, I'm in The Blob. I play this mean nurse.
Uh-huh. Well, great. Listen, can I ask you to leave us with one of your poems?
Oh, my poem?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes. Well, I wrote this when I was 15, you know. And it goes just like this. I am the sea, you are the river. You run to me, I take you in. I hate my parents.
I love it.
Thank you.
Margaret Smith, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Margaret Smith performs this weekend at Caroline's at the Seaport in New York. And you can see her in the film The Blob.
Someday I want my own talk show. Yeah. It'll be different. It'll be one where I get to hit people. You know, like I'll have Sting on, and when I ask him what his name is, and he says Sting, I backhand him. You know, now get over there and sit with Tommy Toon. I've been kind of crabby all week. My parents came to visit, you know. Actually, I just brought them back to the airport today. Yeah, they leave tomorrow. I couldn't take them anymore. Then my mom wanted to know why I don't come home for the holidays anymore. I said, well, I can't get Delta to wait in the yard while I run in.
This is Fresh Air.
I'm Robert Siegel, host of NPR's All Things Considered, with a look ahead at today's program. Starting with today, quail questions in New Orleans. Republicans convening there are both asking and answering questions about how Dan Quayle got into the Indiana National Guard during the Vietnam War years, did influential and wealthy relatives place phone calls to help him avoid the draft. Also, a talk today with Jerome Siegel, the University of Maryland philosophy teacher who's been involved with Palestinian groups in their efforts to draft a declaration of independence from Israel. Also, a talk today with Patsy Montana. More than 50 years ago, she recorded I Want to Be a Cowgirl's Sweetheart, and she's still singing it. Those stories coming up on All Things Considered later on National Public Radio.
Director Jonathan Demme's films include the concert movie Stop Making Sense, the quirky Melvin and Howard, and the offbeat Something Wild. Demme's new film, which opens this weekend, is a romantic comedy called Married to the Mob. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
Jonathan Demme is a director with a very special gift. He knows what makes characters likable. Now, most art forms can do without likable characters. I mean, is Raskolnikov likable? Do we feel like chatting up Don Giovanni or tossing back a few with old King Lear? The very question seems absurd. But there's something in the alchemy of movies that demands companionable characters. From Charles Chaplin to Woody Allen, from Jean Renoir to Jean-Luc Godard, likableness has been a serious artistic concern. It's not enough for a character to be nice. As Demme himself once told me, we like a character because of the way he behaves. And in a Jonathan Demme movie, the flow of pleasing behavior is as sinuous and revelatory as a superbly composed aria. Watching it, you realize that likableness functions in movies the way the flow of song functions in an opera, the way the flow of language operates in the theater, or the flow of articulated thought in a novel. It's the movie's circulatory system. In the mafia comedy Married to the Mob, Demme begins daringly by making his characters instantly dislikable. As Angela DeMarco, the dazzling wife of an up-and-coming hitman, Michelle Pfeiffer is prickly and withdrawn, and snooty about mixing with the other mob wives. She's having some troubles with her husband.
Your life is so bad. You have a beautiful house, you have plenty of money, you have a great kid, you have a husband who loves you. What more do you want from me?
I want a normal life. I'm sick and tired of the gambling, the guns, bailing you out of jail, never knowing when you're gonna come home, if you're gonna come home. Look at this place. Everything we wear, everything we eat, everything we own fell off a truck.
Shh, take it easy, baby.
But Angela's marital troubles are soon over. The mob boss, played to the hilt by Dean Stockwell, rubs out her husband and then puts the moves on Angela. So our heroine gives up the vulgar splendor of Long Island and flees with her young son to Manhattan's grim Lower East Side. Now we meet FBI agent Mike Downey, played by Matthew Modine. He's following Angela because he thinks she'll lead him to Dean Stockwell. At first, we don't like Modine either. He's a stiff-necked, soap-scrubbed throwback to the J. Edgar Hoover era. But even these character details are tossed at us with a wink. And it isn't long before Pfeiffer and Modine begin to exude that yummy radiance that marks Demi's best characters. And as Demi launches the stream of tiny revelations that will seduce us into loving them, he brings his camera in closer and closer. Watching this movie is like taking part in a mating dance. The more we see of these two, the hungrier we grow for their next gesture or grin. The movie pops with in-jokes, outré bits of casting, little eager-to-please moments that do. Demi's camera circles and tilts, and the underrated actress Mercedes Ruel delivers a luscious, bombs-away performance as Stockwell's infernally jealous wife. Like all Demi's films, Married to the Mob is about second chances, about good people who've screwed up and are trying to start all over. And the movie's slapsticky broadness sometimes sabotages the intimacy Demi needs to make that theme touching. But no matter. Demi has pulled apart the gangster comedy genre and then hammered it back together again to accommodate his own peculiar interests. The result is jumpy, romantic, and very, very funny.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, filmmaker Earl Morris directs documentaries that have been described as crosses between 60 Minutes and a Laurie Anderson performance piece. His new film, The Thin Blue Line, is about the murder of a Dallas police officer. Also, critic at large Laurie Stone says serious political humor has been on hiatus for the last few years, but if that changes, then comic Lewis Black is ready for a breakthrough. Laurie says Black gets his material from the 6 o'clock news and works it into his 8 o'clock show. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Audrey Voblitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.